Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Gerald Harris, Chair of the Club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forums, and your host today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now it is my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Dr. Jim Williams. Dr. Jim Williams is a chief scientist at Energy and Environmental Economics, the respected San Francisco consulting firm, and a thought leader on energy and climate policy. Dr. Williams has consulted on many aspects of energy technology, planning, and regulation for government, utility, and industry clients. In 2007, he led E3's analysis for California's state agencies on greenhouse gas reduction strategies, which became the key input for implementing the Assembly Bill 32, the state's groundbreaking climate change policy. Without further ado, Dr. Jim Williams.
Thank you, Gerald, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming out tonight. Earth's climate is under serious threat. Global greenhouse gas emissions are still rising, more than 40 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent per year. Atmospheric CO2 concentrations are increasing at about 2 parts per million per year. Land and sea ice are melting at an alarming rate, and 2014 was the warmest year on the instrumental record. Climate scientists tell us that in order to avoid the worst impacts of climate change, we need to limit warming to less than 2 degrees Celsius. And they further tell us that in order to do that, we need to decrease greenhouse gas emissions to net zero by the latter quarter of the century, 2075 or so. We need to be most of the way there by mid-century. A common benchmark is 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions below 1990 levels by the year 2050, often referred to as the 80 by 50 goal. It's the goal that's been adopted by the United States after the Copenhagen meeting, by the EU, by California and other states. And it represents a deep decarbonization of the economy and energy system. Is deep decarbonization even possible? How would we do it? Could we afford it? Can we imagine the steps to get there? My colleagues at E3, at Lawrence Berkeley Lab, and at Pacific Northwest National Lab and I have explored this for the United States over the last year or so, in parallel with similar efforts around the world. And this is my topic tonight. I'm used to presenting this information with charts and graphs, and so tonight's going to be storytelling instead, so I hope you bear with me. In order to provide some dramatic tension in lieu of visuals, I am going to relate this story in terms of 4 seeming paradoxes that characterize the work. The first is that developing a long-term technical vision of the transition to a low-carbon economy is essential for actions taken in the short term. The second seeming paradox is that deep decarbonization will profoundly transform the energy system itself, but its effect on people's daily lives will be relatively small. The third is that deep decarbonization will profoundly change where the money goes in the energy economy, but have only a small impact on what people spend for energy goods and services. And the final counterintuitive, maybe finding that I'll relate, is that political opposition to climate change is less of an obstacle than most people think, and that we are already doing more than most people think, and that the real challenge in front of us lies in doing a good job of the initiatives that are already begun. Last November in Beijing, President Obama and President Xi Jinping of China surprised the world by making specific commitments for the U.S. and China on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. This news of the two main antagonists in previous negotiations forming a partnership on climate has changed the playing field for international climate cooperation. In the U.S., China's commitment has removed a key political excuse for inaction, while internationally, it has removed the firewall between the global north and south in which developing countries previously had no specific obligations to limit emissions. That is now changing, and with it, the changing requirement for industrialized companies to not only reduce their own emissions but to support emission reductions in developing countries has become much less of a theoretical question. In December of this year in Paris, the 21st Congress of the Parties of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change will be held to establish a new international agreement on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. There is positive momentum going into COP21 from the U.S.-China announcement and some cautious hope for a successful outcome in contrast to what is widely perceived to have been a failure in 2009 at Copenhagen. COP21 will focus on the next 10 years, on national commitments, on financial mechanisms, on support for adaptation to climate change in areas that are already hard hit. But it will also, for the first time, emphasize the need for developing long-term blueprints, that is, for low-carbon transitions in each country, and this emphasis is new and important. The genesis of this new emphasis is the Deep Decarbonization Pathways Project, or DDPP, a collaboration of research teams from 15 largest emitting countries in the world, where each one is asking the question, what would deep decarbonization require in their countries? Being outside of national governments and not entangled with formal negotiations, this process has allowed a unique cooperative exploration of this question. The initial report of the DDPP was released last September at the time of the UN Climate Summit, and it has received a lot of quiet attention for governments around the world. As the leader of the US team, I've had a ringside seat on that process. The origins of the DDPP were with a paper that my colleagues and I published in Science in 2012 that was a robust and detailed analysis of California's ability to meet its 80 by 50 goal. And the finding of that report was that this was technically feasible, that California had options in pursuing that goal, and that it would be affordable. As a result of that paper, a colleague and I were invited to New York to give a talk to the Sustainable Development Solutions Network, which is an NGO created at the behest of UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to support UN objectives. The co-chairs are Jeffrey Sachs, director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University, and Laurence Tubiana, who was formerly director of IDRI, a policy think tank in Paris, and is now the French ambassador for climate change and the person responsible for planning COP21. The DDPP began with a shared belief among all the participants that the approach applied in California, represented in our paper in Science, addressed a key gap in the international process. There was a perception shared by the founders of the DDPP that the underlying failure of Copenhagen, not to mention the failure of climate policy in the US, lay largely in the fact that neither the general public nor policymakers had a grounded understanding of what deep decarbonization would actually require in terms of technologies, costs, timing, infrastructure changes, and generally a vision of how to get there. This led to sparring for advantage in a hypothetical landscape, an exercise in game theory. Our premise was that before designing policy mechanisms, it would be very helpful to know where policy needs to take us, and that before determining how costs will be shared, we should know what those costs are likely to be. The focus on mechanisms has created a public perception of carbon reduction as burden. The discourse has been around carbon taxes and carbon prices and burden sharing and historical responsibility. And the impression that this gives many people is one of paying more and getting less, dead weight losses, take your medicine because you have to, but it's not otherwise something that's very desirable. It's not a very good starting point for contemplating deep decarbonization. By contrast, the DDPP has focused on the low-carbon transformation itself, a robust and detailed analysis of the physical transformation and all of those technologies, infrastructure changes, timing options, and investment requirements. That leads to a very different kind of conversation. The premise of the DDPP is that if all countries engage in this exercise of developing long-term blueprints, and this is a thought exercise, this isn't a commitment that we have to go a certain path decades out into the future. It's a shared thought exercise that if we all do this and we share our blueprints, we share our assumptions, we use transparent modeling methods, we essentially, everyone lays their cards on the table, that and we look in the long term so that it's not tied to very short-term negotiating postures, that this leads, instead of to wrangling over position, instead toward looking for opportunities, mutual benefits, growing markets, trade opportunities, spillover effects. The DDPP process itself has been collaborative and not competitive. There's been a great deal of sharing of methods and data. It is not about the guarding of methods and input assumptions as if they are state secrets. So it's been a very different kind of international process. The initial findings of the DDPP report are found in the September report. The initial finding, the key one, is that a low-carbon transition is possible. And this is itself a profound finding. It's not the final word. There'll be many other studies. There are many other ways to do this kind of work. But it is a great start. And it's starting to build a collective vision from the bottom up. The relationship to the negotiations is this. We can ask, do our short-term policies put us in a position to achieve deep decarbonization in the long term? The seeming paradox of the deep decarbonization pathways is that the focus on the long term actually does enable action in the short term by making the objectives more clear. And so if the approach begun by the DDPP spreads, and countries focus on concrete requirements for deep decarbonization based on rigorous analysis, I think there's cause for grounded hope for international climate cooperation. The U.S. 80 by 50 study was issued as a companion to the DDPP report, not coincidentally on the day of the Obama-Xi announcement, and that's the rest of what I'll be talking about here today. There are only two ways to reduce CO2 emissions from an economy. One is to reduce the energy used to supply goods and services, heat, light, transport, etc. and the second is to reduce the CO2 that's released in supplying the energy used. Everything you do in deep decarbonization is one of those two things. The questions that we undertook in the 80 by 50 study for the U.S. is this technically feasible? What are the options? What does it cost? The approach we took is not a forecast. This is not a prediction of what's going to happen in the future. It's what we will have to make happen in order to achieve the goal. If anything, this is a backcast. It starts with 80 by 50 and works backwards and says what will be required. To do this work, we built a tool called Pathways. And it's basically an accounting tool for the whole U.S. energy economy, keeping track of where energy comes from and goes to. The U.S. is a big energy system. The relationships are complex, and so it requires a sophisticated accounting tool. And so basically all energy supply and end-use infrastructure and equipment stocks are represented in this model. Power plants, houses, cars, trucks, commercial buildings, lights, refrigerators, heaters, you name it. The model tracks vintages and additions and retirement year by year in each of the 9 U.S. Census divisions. The 50 states are divided into 9 U.S. Census divisions. This is a little nerdy, but a key element of the model is that it includes an hourly electricity dispatch model that balances supply and demand in every hour of the year. And that is a feature that makes this work especially useful and credible. The model is required to meet certain requirements that make the results useful and interesting. And those requirements are ones that people will be expecting to know about in order to understand how to take the results. So, for example, does deep decarbonization require major technology breakthroughs? Is this predicated on technological miracles happening, basically? And the answer is no. The model assumes existing technologies that are either commercial already or near commercial. And that means practically that you could put on a hard hat and I could take you somewhere and show you that technology in operation somewhere. Does deep decarbonization require everyone to change their lifestyle? No, again, the model assumes energy services that are at a level that's very similar to today's lifestyle. Based on the Department of Energy's long-term forecast, the annual energy outlook reference case. That's not to say that getting out of cars, having more vegetarian diets, putting on sweaters instead of turning up the heat, growing more food in community gardens, is not to say that that isn't a good thing. That's a very good thing, and it's really the genesis of a lot of bottom-up action that can generate other change. But in our relatively conservative assumptions that we modeled, that isn't a requirement. If you do those things, everything is cheaper and easier. But even if you don't do those things, we can accomplish this. Another related question is deep decarbonization compatible with vigorous economic growth? And the answer is, again, we assumed what's in the reference case forecast of the Department of Energy, which is actually a whopping 2.5% average annual economic growth. We end up with a $40 trillion economy in 2050 compared to our $17 trillion economy today. And the model provides energy services that are consistent with that level of economic output. So what does deep decarbonization require? We find that it will entail a wholesale transformation of the U.S. energy system and energy economy to achieve the needed reduction in the two pillars of energy use and CO2 removal from energy supplies. And that even without major technological breakthroughs, this transformation can provide the energy services we demand and support vigorous economic growth. At a high level, there are 4 things we need to do. We need a very energy efficient energy system. And so in all of our scenarios, energy intensity of GDP is about 3 times what it is today. We need to decarbonize electricity, about 97% CO2 free, which is about 30 times less than today per kilowatt hour consumed. We need to do a lot of electrification across all scenarios that meet the 80 by 50 goal. More than about 50% of end uses are derived from electricity, use energy derived from electricity. And then for end uses that are hard to electrify, the fourth thing that we need to do is switch to lower carbon fuels. Pathways models all of this in detail. It explores multiple options. And now I want to give a few details about that transformation and how it might affect people's lives in 2050. So first, electricity plays a pivotal role on both the supply and the demand side of the energy system. It is the energy source that we have the greatest ability to decarbonize. We know how to do it. It can replace fossil fuel combustion in many end uses, transportation, space and water heating, industrial equipment. And also, in many applications, including the relevant ones, it has higher inherent energy efficiency. There's a thermodynamic benefit to using electricity, for example, in an electric drivetrain in a vehicle that is more efficient fundamentally than an internal combustion engine drivetrain will be. There are three main options for supplying decarbonized electricity: renewable energy, wind, solar, geothermal. There's nuclear. There's carbon capture and storage. Which of these paths are chosen are going to be societal decisions, not entirely based on cost, because people have concerns, for example, about the safety of nuclear power relative to accidents and storage of spent nuclear fuel and susceptibility to terrorism, for example. Carbon capture and storage is still an emerging technology. For those who are not familiar, it means basically you combust fossil fuels, you capture the CO2 out of the smokestack, and you bury it underground. There are three large-scale power plant projects currently underway as pilots in North America right now, one in Canada, two in the United States. And presumably we'll learn a lot more about CCS from those experiments. But CCS also is not a panacea. Each one of these kinds of technologies has its own set of choices, and they need to be informed by social opinion about what direction to go in. Electric reliability depends on constantly balancing supply and demand. In the current system, we turn fossil fuel generators up higher and down lower in order to meet demand. The more intermittent renewable energy you have, the more a new approach to balancing is needed. And one very interesting result of our model is that at high levels of renewable energy, a good way to balance the system is also a good way to produce some of the combustion fuels that you need for use in applications that aren't easily electrified, and that is to take excess generation from solar or wind power and use that to electrolyze water and create hydrogen or synthetic natural gas and use those for other activities. Electricity is the energy supply of choice, as I mentioned, but there do need to be other options in things like freight shipping, where the energy density of batteries, we don't really foresee that unless there is a big breakthrough being sufficient on a short timeline. And so you need these other fuels. And one other kind of elegant solution that emerged from our work is that it might be possible to take the existing natural gas transmission and distribution system and turn that into a system that distributes a more decarbonized fuel that could be a mixture of fossil natural gas with gas derived from biomass or gas derived from electricity. Now let's briefly imagine the year 2050 in this deeply decarbonized system. As I mentioned at the outset, the paradox is that we're talking about a huge transformation of the way energy is supplied, and yet for an ordinary person, I think it's going to feel just about the same. You flick the switch and the light comes on, or maybe you talk to your wall and the light comes on, and if it doesn't, it's not because there won't be reliable electricity, it's because your computer is mad at you. And that's a bigger concern to me. The same is true with your house heating and your hot water, and you probably won't notice unless you're a real sort of home repair person that you've replaced a gas or oil furnace with the electric heat pump. You drive an electric or fuel cell car, and most people probably won't notice what's under the hood. There will be ways of fueling these, and if you run out of juice, it's still going to be your fault, not the fault of the supply system. How much stuff does all of this add up to? Let me just give you some numbers to think about. Up to 315 million alternative fuel vehicles, electric vehicles, fuel cell vehicles, different kinds and different scenarios. Basically doubling the electricity supply. If you're doing it with nuclear energy, it would be building about 350 nuclear power plants. We currently have 100. If we did it with renewables or with carbon capture and storage, you have to build the amount that gives you the equivalent of electricity production. 12 billion, that's billion with a B, LED lights. Installed in homes, 225 million heat pumps installed in homes. This is a vast manufacturing operation. At the same time, what goes down in all of these cases is fossil fuel use. Across all scenarios, greater than 90% reduction in oil use. And in all except for the high carbon capture and storage case, zero coal in the year 2050. I've just described how we could achieve deep decarbonization technically. What would it cost to do this? Can we afford it? Can we afford 315 million alternative fuel vehicles? And the answer from our analysis is yes. We calculate net cost, which is the change in what we pay to supply and use energy between low-carbon scenarios and the DOE's reference case. And it includes both new cost and savings. And so consistent with the physical changes I've just described, we spend more on capital investment in things like clean power generation, clean transportation, clean buildings, and clean industry. And we spend a whole lot less on coal, oil, and natural gas. Our best estimate of the cost is that it's about 1% of GDP in the year 2050, with an uncertainty, since we don't have a crystal ball, looking at high fuel prices and low fuel prices and high technology costs and low technology costs. That uncertainty range is about itself plus one or plus or minus one percentage point. So ranging from a little bit net negative, where you're actually saving money just in energy terms alone, to up to a little less than 2% of GDP. And to put that, the main projection is 1%, and to put that in perspective, currently in the U.S., we spend about $1 trillion a year on fossil fuels, that's trillion with a T, and about $500 billion on electricity. And that's just a little less than 10% of our GDP. And for comparison, we spend about 17% of our GDP on healthcare. So you might think of this additional 1% for the decarbonized system as constituting something along the lines of a 10% increase in what we pay for energy goods and services. For ordinary people, household spending on energy costs, we estimate would increase by about $25 per household per month. And the nature of that change mirrors the economy as a whole. You spend less on gasoline, you spend less on heating fuel, you spend more on a cleaner car, you spend more on efficient appliances. But on the whole, there's not a very big change in cost. So this 1% of GDP, what do we get for that cost? In addition to a brand new 21st century energy system, we get avoided climate change. By transforming our energy system, the U.S. leads the rest of the world, and the result might be avoiding the worst impacts of climate change. We get avoided air pollution impacts on public health. Fossil fuel combustion is the main contributor to that right now. We get avoided disasters associated with fossil fuel supply, like the exploding train cars of crude and the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. And we get avoided water use, a sensitive subject here in California, associated with fossil fuel production and use. What we get instead is basically a new energy economy that has two key characteristics. The first is that fixed capital costs dominate over fuel cost. This kind of energy system is dominated by capital investment in infrastructure and equipment rather than by purchases of fuel. It is a manufacturing and construction intensive energy economy rather than a fuel extraction energy economy. Energy supply investments are much more equally distributed geographically rather than being concentrated in a few fossil fuel rich regions. They're also more distributed across different types of industry rather than being concentrated in only a few. The second characteristic is that this kind of energy economy has much more predictable cost and a much more stable investment environment than an economy that is pegged to the price of a volatile international commodity, namely a barrel of oil. We're going from an economy that is tied to the price of the barrel of oil to one that is tied to, if you will, a green kilowatt hour. And what that really means is it's tied to technology, to manufacturing efficiency, and to domestically sourced resources. The International Energy Agency estimates that in the next few decades there's going to be $50 trillion of investment worldwide in the energy system. Every society is faced with the choice of how that money should be invested. And we have a choice as a society of whether to invest in the energy system of the 19th century for supporting our 21st century economy that is characterized by low efficiency of energy use, high throughput rates of fuel, and large resource rents by those who own and supply that fuel, concentration of wealth and a host of externalities ranging from national security entanglements in oil-producing regions to air pollution and climate change. The other path is characterized by high end-use efficiency, high technology, advanced manufacturing techniques, wide geographic and sectoral distribution of investment, and a rebuilt U.S. infrastructure. And with that, dramatically lower greenhouse gas emissions and air pollution. This is an energy economy in which most people will benefit. And so the question I would ask is, where do you think we should place our bets? We can achieve deep decarbonization technologically, and we can afford it. I've made this argument. That affordability lies in large part because we still have enough time, according to our modeling, to change over our infrastructure gradually without early retirement. But we have run out of time to delay. Much long-lived infrastructure, buildings, power plants, industrial boilers, has an economic lifetime that's the same order of magnitude as the time remaining between now and mid-century. That's 35 years from now. Long-lived equipment that is being built or installed now must be low carbon, and if it is not, we will either miss the emissions reduction target or require the premature replacement of this infrastructure later at great cost. Transforming the U.S. energy system with all deliberate speed will sound difficult to many people because they assume today's political environment makes it impossible. Indeed, there is a schism in Washington that reflects our national dysfunction. There are powerful players with vested interest in the status quo and denialists who do their dirty work. There's no cooperation in Congress on much of anything, and certainly no comprehensive federal climate policy, no national cap-and-trade system, no carbon tax. The last climate bill to even make it to the floor of Congress died in 2010. Yet despite the politics and the vested interests, there's a lot happening right now at the federal, state, and local level that can give us a measure of hope, and spaces are opening up to do a lot more. The Obama administration has undertaken a number of meaningful executive branch actions in the absence of new legislation. Federal fuel economy standards have already taken a big bite into oil consumption, with much more to come. Federal energy efficiency standards for appliances have transformed the markets for everything from refrigerators to lights, leading to efficient advanced technologies that also save money. The EPA's Clean Power Plan is going to hasten the U.S. transition out of coal into cleaner sources of electricity. It was precisely because these measures are under executive branch control that the Obama administration's 2025 target announced in Beijing of 26% to 28% reductions in emissions below 2005 levels is believable by other countries. This level, N25, by the way, is consistent with the deep decarbonization trajectories in our scenarios. California is leading the way on the energy transformation. It is in the process of setting a 2030 emissions target consistent with the 80 by 50 goal. A process that we have helped to inform through a pathways analysis similar to that for the U.S. Governor Brown's inaugural address earlier this year highlighted three key elements of the state's strategy: increasing the percentage of electricity from renewable energy to 50%, reducing petroleum use in vehicles by 50%, and doubling the energy efficiency savings from buildings. These are very ambitious policies. And not only the rest of the country, but the rest of the world is looking at what California is doing. If California continues to succeed economically while drastically reducing its emissions along these lines, this model will be immensely influential. In my view, the real challenges that we face are not so much the political barriers that we're rightfully concerned about, but that we are already finding ways to work around, just like an incoming tide around sandcastles. The real challenges we face are actually in doing a good job. We've already set out ambitious goals. We're already doing a lot, I think more than most people think. Where California, for example, already gets 25% of its electricity from renewable sources. We know a lot more about how to do that. And we're headed now to 50% by 2030. This is a big deal. And doing it right is going to be really essential. That means planning and regulatory institutions making good decisions. It means incorporating public input by doing things transparently. It means effectively managing the low-carbon transition, anticipating what needs to be done well into the future, coordinating well across sectors and jurisdictions. the energy system is a crazy quilt of different jurisdictions. People who work in this sector know that very well, federal, state, local authorities, and so forth. And California is an excellent real-world example of what these kinds of challenges are. How to make building energy efficiency programs more effective. I'm looking at somebody who basically spent most of his life working on that. How to site solar and wind power while protecting wildlife habitats. How to coordinate planning and operation of the electric grid system in the western United States to encourage renewable energy and reduce the cost of what are currently dozens of separately operated systems. How state agencies will deal with lost gasoline revenues as electric vehicles become more prevalent. How to determine who bears the responsibility for increased utility greenhouse gas emissions related to electrification of transportation and other things. Developing incentives for consumer adoption of electric vehicles or heat pumps. And addressing potentially regressive equity impacts of different policies. These are just some of the decisions that will have to be made. Many of them California will muddle through. The decarbonization enterprise is something new. We don't have all the answers. There's a Chinese saying, "Mo shi to guo," you cross the river by feeling the stones with your feet. And that is that sort of trial and error approach is inevitable. But in my view, the key to making good decisions along the way is having a clear vision of where we're headed. We need to plant a flag on the far shore called deep decarbonization by 2050. We need to map out some of the routes along the way so that we have an idea of what the options are and the challenges we're likely to encounter. That is the point of our work. Going forward, I think the public should demand a higher level of discourse about this. Arm waving is not enough. Arguments about what is possible or not, what it will or won't cost, should be grounded in analysis that is at least as detailed and thought through as what we presented here today. Thank you.
Our thanks to Dr. Jim Williams for his discussion of the deep decarbonization of the United States. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California. We now open the floor to questions. Please keep your questions short. If you have a question, please raise your hand and speak into the microphone as we are recording.
Hi, that was great. I have a question, though. When I was a kid getting started as a scientist, it was just take it for granted the breeder reactors would take care of the energy problem. And then Three Mile Island blew up and you never heard any more about it. Did you turn up anything about breeder reactors that would say that they don't work anymore or something?
I think the U.S. discontinued its breeder reactor program quite a long time ago. And the problem is the leaky fuel cycle. Because breeder reactors, by their nature, they take a certain amount of uranium and you end up getting a lot of plutonium out of that breeder reactor while you're making energy, and then you have to send the plutonium to be reprocessed and then fabricated into fuel to run other reactors. And that is a sort of a very dirty process, and it is one that involves moving a lot of radioactive materials around, and I think the taste for doing that has really receded.
All politicians care about jobs, and I was wondering, you did calculation of the economic output, but did you get into calculation of net job creation, or do you foresee adding that to the analysis?
Well, the making job estimates is really the task of general equilibrium models of the economy, and that's not the kind of model that we built. We built an energy accounting tool. But I do think it would be very interesting to see what people who have those models and aren't afraid to use them will do with this information, because it's hard not to imagine that the production of 315 million alternative vehicles and 12 billion LEDs could produce a lot of jobs. One thing that that does bring up is the question of in this manufacturing intensive energy economy, where's the manufacturing done? And so it asks you whether the United States has an industrial strategy and the will to reindustrialize. Well, I think the low-hanging fruit so far have been in the area of appliance efficiency. That's something that we've been doing for decades now. There's the federal standards. Refrigerators are many times more efficient now as a result of those actions, and they use a lot less energy, and they've saved the need to build a lot of power plants. That's one area. Electricity is a big current focus, and California is one of the global leaders in putting renewable energy onto the electricity grid and figuring out how to operate it reliably without a big cost increase. The next steps are going to be moving toward electrification of vehicles. California currently has a mandate for 1.5 million zero emission vehicles by the year 2023. That actually is not as much as we think we're probably going to need. I think our number was 7 or 8 million zero emission vehicles by the year 2030. To have that happen, a big issue was going to be the transformation of markets so that consumers rapidly adopt things. You can sort of force policies on the supply side, because you control what the utilities do, for example. And you can say, as we do in California, you're going to be required to have a renewable portfolio standard of 50% by 2030. On the side of the energy consuming equipment, a lot depends on consumer adoption. And that's much more of a sort of interactive process. So how you build markets that create volume and bring prices down to where you basically have the equivalent of an electric Corolla that sells for what a Corolla does, that's the challenge of the next 10 or 15 years. We need to really ramp these things up around the year 2030.
Very informative presentation. Thank you. I have a statement and a question. There's a rumor going on that California will be out of water in a year. I was wondering, from your perspective, from a change leadership standpoint, what top three priorities have to happen in San Francisco in order to change citizen behavior?
I've seen a lot of casualties of the water wars, so I think I'm not going to wade into that question right now. Forgive me.
He's had his hand up a long
time. Whoa, not that one.
Hi. Sorry to come late to your presentation. I agree with all that you're saying, but 80% by 2050, in my mind, is business as usual, and business as usual is incredibly risky given the Arctic ice sheets, West Greenland ice sheets that are melting, East Antarctica is beginning to melt, permafrost in the Russian Arctic. I see a need to take what you've said and have it happen in 15 years, not 40 years. How do you speed this up? Because the timing is getting very critical. How do you get people to work who are going to be put out of work in the energy industry? You have to, things are getting really desperate from my perspective, and we have to move much quicker than 80% by 2050, as lovely as your presentation was.
I think one thing that we'll see at COP21 is that 80 by 50 is going to be seen as a conservative position by some, in the sense that you already said, just because people do have a sense of urgency. What I would caution is that it's we're informed by the science, and the science does need to draw lines on paper and tell us what our carbon budgets are. There's no question about it. Our focus has been on what do you need to do to make a transformation. If you do those things, you may not be constrained by, for instance, the retirement at natural lifetimes that we found and that we, in fact, imposed on our model. It's possible that if there are sort of rapid accelerations and cost decreases, that the changeover won't be slow and gradual over 35 years. It'll be more rapid. But I don't think that's necessarily something that you can push through an analysis like ours. Ours is about what a sort of sequential transition would look like. And if, in fact, people are able to accelerate that, I think that's something that needs to happen on the ground rather than in a model where if you did it in the model, people will say this is completely unrealistic. So,
great presentation. Thank you. I'm curious about your opinions on the role that individual behavior plays in achieving a low carbon future, and if it does involve a lot of individual behavior change, what is the rationale there? Is it, you know, we have this crisis, we need to do something about it, or is it you don't even notice, it's just changing times, now instead of getting into a gas guzzling vehicle you get into an EV, and that's just, people don't think about the larger issue behind these changes.
As I mentioned earlier, what we built into the model was the assumption that people a generation from now are pretty much like people today, and that actually creates a taller task to be able to decarbonize that kind of economy. If people do, for instance, bicycle more, get out of their cars, work for better transit options. I know I'd like to live in that society more. If people eat less meat and reduce methane emissions associated with the production of meat and so forth and so on, there's lots of things that would certainly make this transformation easier to achieve. But again, that's something that as a modeler, you can't really build that assumption about behavior change into the model. Where that comes into play, behavior change is something that's built up within the community and by people's example. And if it happens, that's a great thing. Sir, you've had your hand up.
My first comment is I'm wondering how we can clone you and spread you around the country. In your modeling, do you consider that I subscribe to the Sierra magazine of the Sierra Club, and when you read that magazine, there is so much coming online. Have you allowed in your modeling that are you using today's estimates, or are you figuring that you're going to get 10, 15, maybe 20% improvement on all these energy servicing devices? In another, I mean, every year we're it's magnifying, so that you got a curve that won't quit here.
That's a That's a very good question. We do have some what's called learning curves built into our assumptions. I would say they're not radical ones. If you look at long-term, what we've tried to do in the input data for our modeling is to use transparent, widely used public sources. And those tend to be things like National Academy studies. And so there's some inherent conservatism in that because it passes through the review of lots of scientists with lots of opinions. But one thing that we're doing in the DDPP process is that we're aggregating the results of all of the country teams for things like electric vehicle requirements and clean power generation requirements and so forth, and saying if you add all of this up on a worldwide scale and you apply this learning curve to markets that are 10 times or more what they would be in the United States, what would the cost decrease be? And it's going to be large. There's going to be a significant difference. And what it's going to point to is the value of cooperation. And that's one reason, and in response to this gentleman's question, why I think that it is possible that once the ball starts rolling, that it's going to roll very rapidly. Because people are basically, they're going to quit hedging their bets. They're going to see which direction things go in.
Thank you again for a great presentation. I have a child, and I stay up at night worrying about her future. You're giving me a lot of hope, which is great. I wanted to echo the woman in the back who talked about individual acts, what we can do. And buying an electric car is great, but it doesn't seem to have a lot of impact. You talked about raising the level of discourse. Any thoughts on that?
I think it works this time. Well, I think the first thing that we can do is be good citizens, and part of that means putting people in office who will support this transformation, and it also means demanding a better level of discourse about this, where whether they're on, if you will, the other side or our side, you don't get away with hand-waving. You actually make these arguments concrete enough that we can all learn from, and we can find out what's sort of legitimate concern versus what is bogus concern. That will move these things forward. And I think on the individual level, to the extent that we're investors, there are some obvious choices to be made. And to the extent to which we're consumers, I think most of us, anybody who would have come to this talk, would have thought about the consumption choices, and they're similar to what they have always been.
And for our last question,
I have relatives who do not believe in anthropogenic global warming. They do not believe in government regulation. They do not believe in subsidizing renewable power. They do not admit that dirty energy is in fact subsidized in various ways by the government. However, they are perfectly avid to buy clean power if it costs less per kilowatt hour than dirty power. I think most people in the country would be happy to pay less and get cleaner power and get power that happens to be cleaner, but because it costs less. How far are we from simply that transition point where the economics make it compelling rather than regulation or any other political agreements?
I have relatives like that too. I feel your pain. I think it's a very good question. I think what I just said about the size of global markets for low carbon technologies is relevant to that. For electricity in particular, and I look at some of my work colleagues in the back of the room, this is a really complicated question because it's not quite as simple as saying a solar panel comes down to the price where you put it on your roof and it's cheaper than what you buy from the utility. And that's putting aside whether or not there's a subsidy associated with it. Because that electricity actually needs to be stored on a grid, and there are various costs associated with maintaining that grid reliability. I talked about balancing earlier. All that being said, our overall cost estimate I've laid out, there, we anticipate there being some additional costs, but within that there are within the range of uncertainty, it's possible that there could also be cost decreases. And so I don't necessarily see electricity as maybe the prime area for consumer adoption as much as in some area, other areas, for instance, electric cars. If we're able to bring down the cost of electric cars, that's a consumer adoption thing where obviously when you bring those cars to a level that's comparable to an internal combustion car and you're paying less for electricity than you do for gasoline because it uses electricity much more efficiently, that becomes an easy choice. That probably is sometime still away.
Our thanks to Dr. Jim Williams. We also thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.